Good afternoon. This is session 375 of Sunstone. Randomly deleted files, stories, and poems from the Mormon unconscious. And our participants today are Phyllis Barber. I'm not going to do long intros. If you don't know who Phyllis Barber is by now, you're in deep trouble. So Phyllis will be first. Two poets, two fiction writers. Well, and all have dabbled in the other genre as well, or more than dabbled. But Phyllis will be reading new stories, and I believe one of her stories is called Randomly Deleted Files. Vera Bell Clough will read second, an epic poem on a white bullet through India. Terry Holland, who has not yet shown herself, is intended to be third. I hope she'll be walking through that door any minute. And I will be last. My name is Paul Swenson. Terry will give us stories from her fictional bank of work. And I will end up with poetry. Thank you very much for attending. Phyllis Barber.
Okay, I've been working on personal essays lately, but I like to dip into short stories every once in a while, so this is one called Randomly Deleted Files. He's standing in his daughter's kitchen in Phoenix, his thumb hanging inside his dull gray suspenders with a red stripe, his pants barely clinging to his pancake flat butt. He's a snowbird who's flown south for the last time. "My name's Kino," he says in a loud whisper to no one in particular. Slyly, he shifts his right hand to his zipper. His eyes dart like a spy's in a foreign country as he disengages the tiny teeth, one by one. Taking aim at the potted geranium on a saucer beneath the window, he pees on the fuchsia-colored blossom and watches his deep yellow urine drip down the rim of the clay pot. He's watering flowers. That's a good thing. He used to water flowers in his yard on a hot summer day, except now he's using his own hose. As the last of his private supply drips under the thirsty leaves, he remembers he has a wife, maybe because she's tapping him on the shoulder and shaking her head angrily. "Kenneth, that's Joyce's geranium. This is Joyce's kitchen. Don't you have any respect anymore?" Kino giggles a high bird-like sound, like he's an escaped prankster in his wild youth. "Joyce and Blue won't want us here anymore. They don't want their house smelling like a rest home." Kino watches Marlene staring at the shriveled penis in his hand, the one she's seen in so many incarnations. She's looking at it as if it were a comma instead of an exclamation point. "One potato, two potato, three potato, four," he says and giggles again. "Kenneth, stop it. This isn't funny." "My name's Kino. I'm a roadrunner and I'm free." His slippers scuff across the terracotta tile of his daughter's kitchen. He never has liked this tile. It reminds him of something he should have done, but has forgotten. "Do you want breakfast now?" Marlene asks as she wets two sheets of paper towel at the kitchen faucet. Using the back of a chair to support herself, she kneels on her good knee to clean Joyce's floor and to rub out the long drips from the flower pot's side. "This is a big geranium," she says, rubbing a larger dark spot into the pot. "Almost as nice as the one we used to have on our patio in Fallon. You always liked red, didn't you?" "Red, red, red," Kino sings as if it's a word wanting out of his head that feels too full lately. His sinus cavities feel like caves full of garbage. Too many tourists leaving their damn trash behind. "So what about the bathroom? Am I going to have to make sure you use the toilet before I let you come in the kitchen?" "Blow the man down," Kino sings. "Go blow." He giggles again, definitely having a good time. "This is going to get you in a rest home," Marlene says, tossing the crumpled paper towels in the wastebasket under the sink. "Don't take me to the briar patch," he says in a high-pitched voice. "Anywhere but the briar patch." "Stop it, Kenneth. You think you're so clever acting this way, pretending you're a loon." She opens the cupboard and pulls out a cylinder of instant oatmeal. "You're not crazy. You're playing with us.
treating is bad to make yourself feel good. She fills a small pan with water up to two knuckles on her pointer finger. She switches the gas knob onto light, then over to high. She moves smoothly through the routine, anticipating the changes in the water's temperature better than she seems to see them. She measures oatmeal into a stainless steel cup, pours it into the saucepan, and stands over the stove to wait for the water to boil. "We're rusting out," she says. "Old pipes, old tools." She laughs and traces the veined ridges on the back of one hand. "These look like mini mountains and valleys," she says, though Kenneth isn't listening. He's pulled a chair out from under the table and likes the sound of the legs scraping across the floor. He moves it back and forth as if he's been hired to play an unnatural instrument in a punk band. He speeds the tempo. The screechy legs slide back and forth across the tile cracks. "I got rhythm," he sings because he's fond of music. "I got rhythm." He doesn't notice Marlene in her pink flannel housecoat, stirring the thickening oatmeal with a tired hand. He covers his ears with both hands when she says, "Kenneth," too loudly. Marlene loved to dance, and she especially loved to dance with Kenneth, who also loved to dance at insurance conventions. They'd learned to wow an audience, Kenneth guiding Marlene smoothly across whatever dance floor they were on, winking at everyone as they glided past, as if he knew they were being studied, observed, even praised. Marlene liked that. She also liked it when Kenneth took the lead. Once a year, most years, they'd bust out of their small home on a thin street in Fallon, Nevada, and go to his company's convention, Yellowstone, Banff, Colorado Springs, Victoria Island off the coast of British Columbia. Whatever club he qualified for with his lean or fat insurance sales for New York Life. This was the big social event of the year for Marlene. He'd get a special perm and cut, a new dress that whirled prettily for dancing. This was when she felt higher than the top of her game. The year Kenneth made top club for the first time, they drove proudly to Yosemite in their 53 Plymouth with their three children, Joyce, Artie, and Mandy, gawking out the back windows. In their hotel room, while the kids and the babysitter read "Make Way for Ducklings" on the rollaway bed, Marlene, seated in a frame of bright dressing table lights and dressed in a red dress with sequined stars flashing across the bodice, put the finishing touches on her face. Mrs. Mallard was so proud. Joyce was showing off her reading skills to the babysitter. She tipped her nose in the air and walked with an extra swing in her waddle. Waddle. That word made Marlene feel more swingy than she already did. Soon she'd be listening to the big band playing catchy music and watching a real live firefall off Glacier Point, an event she wouldn't miss for the world. She pulled on her nylons, fastened them to her garters, buckled her red pumps, and powdered her nose twice. A firefall. Think of that. And even better, she and Kenneth were going dancing. Her Kenny Manini, her best friend. She loved his smile, his moony blue eyes, even his balding head. And she especially loved his way with his leading hand that pushed her gracefully around the floor. She just wished he had more gumption. That's what he needed, gumption. He needed to be more hard-nosed if he wanted to get ahead in life. Right now, as she squeezed her lips together to even out the red lipstick and saw the reflection of him sitting in a chair waiting for her, she had a brief thought of bread dough settled into the cushions, so soft and absorbent, even if she didn't really think he was doughy. But how could she get him tough, to seize the day and everything in it, to take the bull by the horns and step out in one of those glittery matador's vests? She wanted something more out of life than softness. She loved him, no doubt. She wanted to keep him. But everyone could use a few improvements, couldn't they? She wanted just once for him to qualify for the million-dollar round table, even the President's Club. Why shouldn't she want the best for Kenneth and their family? But then again, why should she be thinking of this right now when they were at club and soon to be dancing? She caught the corners of her mouth with a last stroke of velvety red and stood to check her full-length reflection in the mirror of the sliding closet door. "You look pretty, Marlene," Kenneth said as he pushed himself out of the armchair. "You'll be queen of the dance floor tonight." She turned her head toward him and smiled, aware of the long arch of her neck as she did, the neck that had been praised by the butcher at the meat market just last week. She dropped her lipstick into her new beaded purse and found her balance in the higher-than-usual heels. "You kids be good now," she said, kissing each one on the forehead, then hooking her arm into Kenneth's. "Let's dance," she wiggled her body with excitement. As they walked into the banquet hall, transformed into a low-lit nightclub of sorts, the band played Night Train. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Marlene hummed as she surveyed the buffet table topped with a centerpiece of tall, autumn leaf-colored candles and chrysanthemums. It looks like they're serving prime rib, and yes, there's some chicken cordon bleu, your favorite, Kenny Minini. Taking their place in a long line to wait for their turn at the food, Marlene tapped her toe and twisted her torso to the music while Kenneth greeted other top club salesmen from Bellevue, Boise, Walla Walla, Vernal. "So," he said to Tom Adams, the salesman from Elko, who looked like a linebacker capable of stopping the best of them, "you made it to Yosemite. You convinced enough people they needed life insurance. Broke the $20,000 sales commission mark, just like you, you duffer." Kenneth punched him with a comrade-type punch on the shoulder as Tom moved on through the crowd, and as Green Street, now being played by a five-piece band, filled people in the room with a desire to dance. "Kenneth," Marlene said, her eyes roving every which way to see anybody she might recognize from last year, her eyes reflecting light like diamonds, "the band's great." "Here's Jerry and Alice," he said. "Remember these two from Sacramento? Jerry," he called out, waving his arm to flag the couple. "There you are with your beautiful wife," the smooth, black-haired Jerry said, holding his hand out, enveloping Kenneth's right hand in both of his, and winking at Marlene. "Remember Alice, my little woman?" Jerry asked, tucking her under his arm. "Remember this girl who knows how to bring the cows in?" "What does that mean?" Marlene said, being she was a literal-minded woman who suddenly felt prickly, her own hard-working farmer days poking out of the sponge of memory despite the candlelight and the fancy clothes she wore. "Do you really know how to bring the cows in?" "It's just a turn of phrase," Jerry said as they casually cut into the line. "She can out-party everybody, can't you, Alice?" Marlene watched Jerry take an affectionate grab at his wife's chin. "Limbo, stroll, twist," Alice said, "you name it." Alice had a little face with a nose Marlene would have killed for in her clumsy adolescent days. She had the kind of cuteness that could still give Marlene subliminal discomfort. When they sat together on a tour bus to the Garden of the Gods last year, Alice told Marlene she'd rank the high school football team under the table after she'd cheerled them to a 14-13 victory. Wishing she had an exotic tail to match, Marlene could only think of when she was captain of the girls' basketball team in southeast Idaho, something that wouldn't be an impressive tidbit to Alice. Alice. Alice, blue gown and all, shimmering in the evening gown decorated with a beaded leaf. "Blue is definitely your color, Alice," Kenneth said, swiping the thoughts out of Marlene's mind. "You two are looking good." "Thank you, Ken boy, you cutie," Alice said, fluttering her eyelids. "Wait till the kids hear that one," Marlene laughed out loud before catching a piece of a silent stare coming from Kenneth in his pale blue eyes. "Ken boy, oh my," she thought, this time keeping her words to herself. "Aren't we having a good time," Alice said, looking past Marlene to wave at someone she recognized. "I'm in the mood." She tapped her blue satin shoe dyed to match her Alice blue gown and bounced her shoulders in time to the music. "And don't think you two can outdance us this year, just because the band leader singled you out." At last year's convention at the Biltmore in Colorado Springs, during a crazy wild rendition of Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White, when the band leader played some rock'em sock'em high notes on his trumpet, Kenneth and Marlene had been inspired. In a grand ballroom covered with crystal chandeliers and on a parquet dance floor surrounded by round tables with many-armed candelabra and white linens, Kenneth went Hollywood on Marlene, bending her back like a pretzel into a deep dip. Marlene felt suddenly Hollywood herself and kicked her leg unusually high on the back bend, so high that the fabric that usually covered her leg slipped to expose her garters. Surprise riffled through the other dancers next to the couple as Marlene felt hot, with showgirl energy and a strident sense of immodesty, something she usually guarded against with her life. The music inspired her deepest impulses. As the trumpeter kept stacking up higher and higher notes, Kenneth twirled Marlene every possible direction, held her close, arched her under his arm, led her backwards across the floor. The two had been music itself, Greenwich perfect timing, at the Biltmore. The band leader had jumped off the riser and marked an imaginary circle around Kenneth and Marlene as he played another variation on a theme. He set them apart from the rest of the dancers, made a special place for them. Everyone else had stopped dancing, bewitched by the fire that burned in Kenneth and Marlene as they responded to the glory of the crescendo. The fire coursed through their arms and fingers as if they were inventing it, as if they'd wrested a spark from flint. It was potent, a moment in the history of Top Club and in the annals of Marlene's mind, never to be forgotten. Oh, I can't believe it. Alice's mouth and eyes suddenly lit up big O's as she waved at someone across the crowded room. There's Nick and Katie. Sorry, you two, but we haven't seen the Millers since who knows when. Nice chatting with you. She grabbed Jerry's hand, and Marlene watched them make their way into the crowd. She and Kenneth were obviously not scintillating enough to hold their interest. See you on the dance floor, Ken boy, Jerry said with a parting shot wink, yielding to Alice's firm pull on his hand. Please direct your attention to the east window. Kenneth and Marlene heard a voice over the loudspeaker. The drummer in the band started a buzzed press roll on his snare. Marlene reached for Kenneth's hand and strained her eyes to look high up in the distance, where a bed of orange embers moved closer and closer to the edge of the cliff, where the coals teetered at the edge until they were nudged into free fall, where they changed shape and fell apart as muted fire tumbled down, down, and down. Falling fire, she whispered. Oh, my. Since our other person didn't come on. Hey, this is back to the house in Arizona. Kenneth, who is definitely Kino tonight, sits on a sofa in a circle of family. His daughter Joyce's salt-of-the-earth husband, Blue, sits next to him dutifully, giving the younger nieces and nephews and grandchildren a turn on his strong knee, asking each one what they're supposed to be getting for Christmas. They're like little Martians, Kino says to Blue out of the corner of his mouth after one of the children jumps to the floor and bumps him in the process. No doubt, Kino sabe. Blue tickles Kino in the ribs, making him laugh. You and I don't belong here, Kino says. We should have been born somewhere else and not with these jokers. When will Artie get here? He can't come, remember? Too much snow in Colorado for him to drive like he was going to. I want to see Artie. He's my only son, you know. I'm right by your side, Kino, Blue says. Never fear. The stout-hearted men club members stick together. Grandpa, Julian says. Joyce and Blue's 14-year-old son has walked up to the sofa where Kino and Blue are sitting. Stop calling me Grandpa. Kino clutches his fists and snaps to attention on the sofa. I'm Kino, U.S. Navy. He salutes Julian with crisp fingers and speaks like a recording. Kenneth Ardmore, reporting for duty, ensign first class. You go, Grandpa, Julian says, his curly black hair larger than his eagerly smiling face. Tell us about the time you went through that channel when the Japanese were shooting at your battleship from both sides. Julian, Marlene says as she passes a tray of cookies on a cut glass plate, stopping in front of each child, young adult and adult, to let each one choose from her cut out and frosted array. Don't get him started, Kino mimics his wife's words in his favorite falsetto. Why can't Julian get me started, he asks defiantly, though Marlene is handing a cookie to a 2-foot-tall grandchild and doesn't act interested in his question. But Grandma, Julian complains, he's the only interesting thing here. Julian, Marlene said, for once would you just listen, please? It was an escort cruiser, not a battleship, Kino stands up as if he's been asked to address Congress. He's on stage and has an audience. All the little children have stopped running around, captivated by this change in landscape. He minces his steps, playing the part of an oriental woman with bound feet. Xiao, xiao, son, he sings in a wannabe Chinese opera voice. Julian snorts and gives Kenneth a high five. You go, big boy. Marlene rolls her eyes. Kino notices, and in a commanding officer's voice he says, Marlene, sit down and listen. Holding her tray of cookies with two hands, Marlene cooperates, backs into the flowered easy chair, and sinks deep into its cushions with a sigh. Julian cozies up to Kino. And what about the girls who wanted to, you know, sell you on a good time with some Tsingtao and, you know, the word that rhymes with cookie? Joyce, Marlene says as Joyce enters the room with a tray of Panook and spun peanut brittle. Would you talk to your son, please? Julian, his mother says sharply, are you egging on your grandfather? Who's egging on who, Julian asks. You egged me to come over tonight, and now you're egging me to eggshell it with Grandpa. Exactly what do you want? You're exaggerating again, she said with raised eyebrows and the look of a woman wise to teenagers and their sass. You know he gets out of hand. Those China girls wanted me to buy a baby girl when I said no to the nookie nookie. Kino bends over as if to whisper into Julian's ear, but speaks loudly nonetheless. I would never buy someone's baby for $2. A tear rolls down his cheek. $2, they told me. His hands open and close as if they're looking for a comfortable position at his side. Julian. Joyce presses her elbow sharply against her son's arm, even as she balances the candy on her Christmas plate. Kino watches all of this. He watches his grandson ignoring his mother, then watches his daughter grabbing one arm and pulling her son back toward the kitchen. "Look what you've started, you little turkey," she's saying, none too quietly. "Why don't you ever listen to anybody? He'll be blubbering his little nookie song next. This is a family gathering. Children, you know." "He's going to talk, Mother. Well, you started it." Kino stands by himself in front of the sofa with more tears running down his cheeks. "It was just a little baby $2, he says in another version of what he imagines to be his oriental voice. "What about the flying pig, Grandpa?" Julian yells across the room as if determined to undo the damage he's done. He's privy to the common knowledge that Grandfather can be put back on track with those magic words. "It wouldn't be Christmas if we didn't hear your flying pig story." "Tell your story," Kino Blue says as Kino paces the floor in front of his place on the sofa. "Gather round, you kids." "The flying pig's bitchin'," Julia says over the chaos of little children smashing into the spot in front of Kino, holding paper plates curled between their hot little hands, sitting cross-legged on the floor and dropping cookies and their crumbs on Joyce's rug. "A pig missile. Listen up, you kids." "The flying pig has a tail," Kino says, wiping the tear from his cheek and putting the thumb of that hand inside a suspender. The other hand whirs overhead in a wind-up motion and gets himself captured by his favorite story. "Faster than the speed of light. The flying pig dives into the crowd's head first, flies faster than a bullet. He zips past the battle lines and no one can shoot him down. He's too fast. Rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat, rat." With each repetition, the intensity, even hostility, in his voice increases. A toddler who's just learned to walk robots across the room toward Kino with her arms extended, too young to know anything about war or crowds, but mesmerized by Kino's rat-a-tat-tat. "We surrender," Kino continues, gathering more and more steam, now taking the part of the enemy, his arms raising high over his head. "We've never seen a missile like this when it's faster than a speeding bullet." With one hand, he reaches down into his pocket, pulls out his white handkerchief, and waves it in the air. "We surrender," as he shouts, as if he were the last player on a stage about to be dragged to the wings against his will. "We surrender." The grandchildren are all looking up with their mouths open, waiting for they're not sure what. Kino stands there with his hands in the air, the moment frozen because he's noticing Marlene planting three fingers against her bowed forehead, her elbow resting on the arm of the chair. The room is still as Kino's mouth moves like a guppy out of water. He's searching for words that have suddenly hidden from him. He surveys his progeny sitting at his feet. He picks up the suspender that has fallen off his shoulder. He pulls up his pants that have always been too big. He scratches his head, which has never had a plethora of hair except maybe before he was 21. He touches the red scabs, precancerous stuff burned away by the dermatologist a few days ago. He strokes his long forehead that looks like a map of the world with its continental blotches.
Thank you, Phyllis. I love that. You remind me of my dad. Shot through India in a white bullet. India liberates us from the West's insistence on chirpy optimism, which she gently exposes as a lie. Cheryl Bentley, Enchanted. Flying from Udaipur to Delhi, I am exhausted with my inability to write about this experience. The days go quickly. Every morning I wake just before dawn, keeping my stuff together, washing my clothes, meeting the Greek group early to beat the crowds. I am without solace and energy to write. In the Himalayas, there is a place called the Kula Valley. It means the end of the inhabitable world. Kulantapith. If you could put a price on patience, India would be the richest nation in the world. My patience has stretched into marks on my soul, as deep as the watermelon stretch marks on my belly before I birthed my babies. A gray glitch cloud haunts me since before I leave home, My travel companion cancels, leaving me $1,400 extra for my single rooms. My bags lost through the London transfer for 5 days. Registration at the 5-star Crown Plaza does not have my room. And then I burned out my video charger with a faulty adapter. Inconvenience haunts my entire trip, even though my Globus tour is like being shot through India in a white bullet. The tour bus insulates me. If I miss much interaction with the common Indian, I do not escape the strange milieu of exasperating communication and inconvenience known by a visitor to India. Each day, some irritating mistake sets me apart from our group. It continues even as we return home through customs and security, returning to JFK. I lose my passport. Thank God I get back into the USA before I'm stranded in India. I feel sad and unfulfilled, like I missed something profound. I am like a fat man after eating an orgy, filled beyond my capacity to absorb all I have seen and experienced. I close my eyes and I see the faces, the eyes of the beggar, the mothers with babies starving at their breasts, the mutilated by karma, distorted human beings, large masses growing from heads and spines, feet as large as winter squash, a child using a withered leg as a helicopter propeller to chase after a rolling coin, hearing the shrill howl of a mother insulted by the 20 rupees I give her. Luminescence glows through white marble, encrusted with rubies, sapphires, lapis lazuli, garnets, emeralds, wondrous Taj Mahal made by jewelers, tribute to the highest vibration of love, an adoration of a man for his wife. Thrills even the skeptic whose cheeks are washed by tears, the opulence of the world's number one hotel, a floating palace, another made of gigantic sundials. And then I smell the sweet smoke of Varanasi's cremation pyres. I hear a woman beat the dirt out of her laundry on the gnats of the Ganges. The Ganges emerges from an ice cave at the foot of the Ganantri Glacier, 12,770 feet up in the Gomik Himalayas. The cave is known as the Gomik, the cow's mouth. Eric Newby, what the traveler saw. I have a strange stare that comes to the traveler who flies into the sun, chasing it around the world for 28 hours. A force keeps sucking me into a trance as I nod off into the drone of the Delta 757. I spend every cent. I look into the eyes of the untouchables as they rip out of my hands the small tokens I hopefully distribute. Each shampoo I hand to an eager child becomes a magnet for 50 or 100 more children. I pull my heart back in as I struggle for my own survival. I hear my voice shout, "No!" When I really want to embrace them, I am repelled by them in my own heart as it becomes calloused. India has sent me home searching for my own soul. I fear tomorrow and hearing fresh news of the Iraqi war, the hot political election, Hillary, Obama, McCain, find money to pay my taxes, the down payment on a summer vacation with my children, and my teeth, my final caps on my new transplants. It all proves I am a very rich woman, as the fortune teller in the hotel in Agra pointed out. One snake eye and one tiger eye, who is sometimes lazy, with a big heart, who will soon meet a very important man. The exaltation of home kissing the snow, my skin ready to shed the scale of shooting like a white bullet through India, land of no shadow. Everything is out in the light, the frightening light of God. Waking up saying, "Will you love me? Will you look at my naked nature and know how to love me back together? Will you trust the path and continue in patience?" How dare you, Kujahara? Larita is offended by an erotic image of a monkey and man connected through mouth to penis. Can you trust a monkey's teeth? And now that I tell you, is the taboo broken again? Her spirit with a hole of judgment taken on to deflate her illumination. And why didn't I see it? I don't get past what happens to one's spirit when taught to war, mutilate sons and brothers, killing in the name of God. Does God kill Ishmael or Isaac? Why are we at the lowest level of natural man? Taking sons away from their wives and children has a terrible consequence seen on these panels. Why withhold, India? The experience frustrates, the transcends, the judgment. Maybe we all are. Think who you are. As a faded filmmaker, I am titillated back to art. As the dance construction company works in Africa on Farewell to the World as We Now Know It. I could pick up some footage on India's poverty and add it to the video shot in Africa, contribute to Farewell, or shoot my own version. Who knows where the juices will flow? I come home disappointed. All my arrangements fall through, and a part of me dies. I would be fired as a production manager, a photojournalist, a camera person, or an artist. There is something awful about taking pictures of this poverty. Unless, of course, you pay, and then you make them professional poverty people make a good living. It's like funeral people, the Doans, who prepare the dead. They are untouchable, even though wealthy and washed. They are. They sell the flowers, the butter, the wood, and the flame to cremate the dead. They are untouchable to remind them not to be jealous, covetous of a neighbor's caste. But it ensures they live out their role well, eager to do good deeds, to better one's lot in the next life. It's so funny because everything I intended to do was thwarted by circumstance. The unexpected is expected in India. I watch my reaction, and I am not proud to ignore the plight of a starving child and even take her picture. Would it make a difference if I spend a few hours talking with these children? Feeding them, washing them, holding them in my arms? No, Mother Teresa, am I to sit with the starving, to hold the dying? Somewhere deep, I think I would like to, but then the need evaporates. I'm lazy, my social conscience weakened with not doing. I love to serve you, to help change pain and hunger, to find self-sufficiency, and that is the key. But it doesn't work like that in India. I'm smiling now after a cold bath. I see the cloud continues to follow me. Even my own hot water tank is broken. Thousands of thoughts run through my head. Thank you, India, for preserving a museum of human thought from ancient times until now. I look at the poor and wonder, what are you thinking? It couldn't be more than to fill your raw hunger. Too many people to feed. 3 out of 4, 5 die before the age of 3. I would have died long ago in India. I remember ducking out 10 or so times before this incarnation. Repugnant for me to take another's life. Removed from death. Sheltered, innocent, insulated from the feelings evoked from raw hunger. These children know if they can catch the eye of a mother, she will feed them. India teaches not to try to mother everyone. An impossible feat known only to God. Why do we go into our own world? Why do you go into your world? To find a friend? To talk to yourself? They call me sensitive. You're way too sensitive. Things are too loud. I am stripped bare in competition with the Father to be something more. Let the children have their own eyes, their own feelings. Mine are toward the beloved, looking for that drunkard who overdoses on love, the being transcended from suffering, not because it is over, but because it is. To teach the ego to avoid itself, notice the noticing is about awareness that reveals pure light of being that emerges from the dung piles, still alive, curious, looking for more places to wake. Releasing the desire to desire makes me laugh as I see. I always shake off the layer that starts to squeeze me. And when I hurt, I realize I have caused it all by my desire. Shed, shake off, judgment, intolerance, expectation of God, disappointment, pain, hunger, discovering a poverty deeper than understanding, living out reality naked before the world, cast dominion, ancient genealogy living out predicted futures of every man's son, paying the price of karma, each Maharaja, educated at Harvard, gathers his wealth, sees that to some he appears as if chosen by God to be the living, divine illumination of himself, thus deserving every jewel dripping from the neck of Ganesh. Is this nirvana? Is heaven opulent? Does God weave his own robe as Gandhi did? If we know the generation where God first begins to be, does it change the depth of poverty whose eyes haunt my mind? Eyes from children droop from famine, shudders the heart of our mother in heaven, who refuses to witness the folly of willingness to be cast into deprivation, to be obliged to live without murmur and jealousy of those above you. What determines the untouchable bottom, where the maimed and the distorted wreath hope to catch the eye of even the edge of consciousness of someone willing to be a mother to them for an instant of connection to some coin or paper, rupee or dollar, a pen, an orange, candy, hotel shampoo? Give them what you can. It will not be enough. Show Americans the march of the Mongols through India. Wind palace, red, amber, golden forts and Taj Mahal. Threats of the Muslim crusade show the fear mask of an ancient, angry God, intent on accepting prescribed prayers, demanding blood sacrifice of Abraham's son. And what's his name and who's his mama? Am I capable of ignoring God's children, narrowing my gaze, focusing my love closer to home? Can I see and accept this world as the gift? Be a lover of reality, knowing it is a story we tell, an illusion we construct to determine the part we choose to play out in the drama? An ancient dance comes out of my limbs. I find myself in the body of a multi-armed elephant, hands of a man wearing bracelets, rings, strings of emeralds, garnets, rubies, diamonds, pearls cascade down my neck and my arms. I gyrate with jungle drums, primitive strings. I feel life, an amazing joy full of riches when I see them, claim them, flaunt them, share them, and celebrate the dance. The whole of the whole of the beginning, Alpha and Omega, welcomes all in the song and the joy of the hum. Yet, from the ancient hum, is it a string or a pluck? Heard as the bang connects big from the reverberation it leaves as we tumble into this ancient future time that will frighten all but the illuminated. Even then, most will wear sunglasses. Farewell to the world as I now know it. A new dance starts with the ending. The middle defines itself as the living end, goes on to the beginning, to finish. A seed to start a new dance. Farewell. Fini. E. E. And D. I asked him if I
part
should...
Part two.
Part two. I wrote this little one-pager on Africa when I was there last year, so here it is. Ah, Africa. Why did I go to Africa? To hear the dark poetry of her people? To learn her names? Karumbu, Mercy Karamana, Adet Kashi, Yuma Magogo, Ali Mazuru, Kaganju Kagawi. I am a specialist at doing nothing. Being still, I hear drums when I want to dance. Be still and follow the energy up. Kawana Trusi, what do you do? I think of never working again. Is work sacred? What is my work? Is work a privilege? Ask Mombasa. Ask those in Kibera slums. There are no drums. My work is over. And then I see the faces of Kenya, Meru, Samburu, Navasha, Nakuru, Masimara, Tanzania, Zanzibar. I will never be the same. What is the change? More joy, more presence, more abundance, better able to perceive light coming, 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 growing. If they trust, why wouldn't I? I see how I procrastinate, afraid I'll finish, and then what?
Riddell ended that India piece Caldiero-esque. If you don't know who Alex Caldiero is, you need to.
And, I discovered Alex.
Yes, she did, yes. She should be credited with that. Of course, we all did in one way or another, later or sooner. But, wow. I was in the moment with that. That was beautiful. So, being Mormon, we're somehow, if not obsessed, we're involved with perfection and what that could possibly mean. And I thought something really profound was going to come out of me thinking about that. It didn't, but I did write a poem called Perfect, and I will read that to you. Perfect. Be ye therefore, but I'm not, and not sure I'd want to be. Imperfection is a confection that tastes good to me. People who I love the most are those who sometimes burn the toast or break the heart when you're expecting sweet with something tart or salty. And yet, should we find fault that since Al-Qaeda and the war are far from perfect, it's not really out of whack to cut ourselves some slack on torture? Are we daft enough to practice to perfect the craft in order we can better scorch the earth in future wars? There is a cookie that proposes to be perfect. Well, not really. The name is just a brand, and its secret's in the dough. Kept in the refrigerator door 36 hours before baking. Surely I'd be happy, perfectly happy, with just one, wouldn't I? Well, sigh. Nobody's perfect. So you see shop names in the mall and all kinds of things come to mind. And I don't know how this happened exactly, but this is a poem called Bed, Death, and Beyond. And I must say, it has a three-letter word twice in it, which is, you know, you may close your ears, or I hope you won't be shocked. And it comes right away, so, all right. kiss the ass of advertising's history for every dime I made as journalist. So not surprising came to hate the craft that fed me, laughed my ass off at cartoonist Kleban's birth of advertising, little men in pinstriped suits descending from the rear end of a horse, meant to offend, of course, the ad execs, the horsepitutes who sold us sex and beer. Recall those Burma Shave signs showed up outside the window of the car on all those road trips as a kid? Strange how I still miss them. Pissed, could not resist them. Admin had me in a grip that still persists. And now, transcendence at the mall. Read between the lines, cursive scrawl of neon sign that probes the end and redefines our bond with sleep, bed, death, and beyond. Abandon fear, all ye who enter here. Clearance sale attests creature comforts that we crave. Pillows, potions, perfumes, linens, comforters can be taken to the grave to guarantee eternal rest. Oops. Misread the sign. Dead, bath, and beyond. But that's just fine. Love the plain water. Wouldn't grow fond, could grow fond of a bidet. When I die, baptize me in lies of advertising. Well, I drove one person out of the room. So let's hold it. We'll all stay. So, Mormon folk here, they do exist. So, this is a poem called Golden. Hey, Brother Golden, what's it like over there? You ever share your coffee with the other cowboys around that celestial fire? Does it burn as fine and new as you hoped it would when you said you couldn't wait till you were dead to get the final clue as to whether what you'd been preaching all those years was true? They laugh in heaven? Must do, since you arrived. Accident or irony connived to kill you in a car crash, long after hot rodders splashed mud on you, drenched you good at Temple Square, shook your cane, complained, no respect for priesthood. You go blind, trying to find the father of that guy who asked you if you'd mind keeping an eye out for his dad once you reached the other side. Well, was it a crime or just your wit? You said it might take time to look all over hell. Your genealogy through Heber C, does it help in heaven? Odd, you wear the Kimball name, yet nimbly merge the sacred and profane. Miss the old days when you were young. Ways were rough and rowdy, and your tongue was golden. So, Mormon theology. Any of you who heard Paul Toscano earlier in the afternoon brought us back, all the way back to things we may not have even wanted to consider, such as Adam God and other things of that nature. Well, hell. What about hell in Mormon theology? So, this is a poem called Shadows on the Wall. Elevate your thoughts, scriptural message in the elevator said. This was the church's corporate tower where power weds with piety. Well, I thought, this button takes us to the roof, but what of those sent down? Hellish basement of my childhood house was ominous and dark. There, metal's scary rasp on cement floor meant my father shoveled coal into the greedy maw of furnace door. When I saw the shadow of the flames leap on the wall, I shivered. And yet, it wasn't long before I lived for color, in church film, Man's Search for Happiness, pasty flesh of the redeemed, arrayed in spotless white, seemed dead to me. Strange, I feel compelled to tell you that in Mormonism, go to hell, which comes back to Kimball, he used to say that sometimes, is allegorical. Should we be embarrassed that our dogma robs us of revenge, spurns imagining a place where God delights in burning mobs who harassed us? Yet maybe we save face with fellow Christians by confessing that we may believe in an obscure realm in space called outer darkness. There, we're told, it's cold instead of hot. But then we may recall it's not outsiders who'll be locked out in the dark, but those of us, the fallen, who had a spark and snuffed it. Nonetheless, some may find it less than swell. We can't find room in our theology for hell. Rudely, Dante might conclude our canon lacks a certain sweep or magnitude, as well as thirst for ruthfulness. Do tell, among our brethren, there are not a few who wonder where we'll put the pacifists and gays, the liberals yet unchastened by God's wrath in latter days. But if hell is allegory, then the story changes. Final judgment can't be meant to break the human race asunder, but instead to harrow up our hearts. The worst as best, the last as first, then to stitch us back together, bone to marrow. Okay, this is a poem called No, No. It spells two different ways. N-O-K-N-O-W. No, no. Don't know, but I believe. Older I get, less I know. Is knowing then a way of showing off? Knowing is power, I'm told. If I know myself, what does that mean? If I were to know you, what would that mean? Believe I know, but no, even that's a no, no. Would rather leap into the arms of faith, believe me, than trust a lust for knowledge. Don't grieve that I no longer know the truth, uppercase. Said I did, yet in my youth I didn't. Even truth, small t, is elusive. Doesn't mean we shouldn't chase it, hunt it down, embrace it, or when it hogties us, surrender, face it. My dad was a believer, and I believe in something he said. Go slow to claim to know it. So, a little Mormon pop quiz. We have Mormon celebrities now. How about that? So, bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. Her first name, Stephanie. What's her name? Stephanie Meyer. So, I'll tell you a little story about something that happened in regards to her after I read the poem. But I turned on TV a few weeks ago, and another Mormon celebrity, Glenn Beck, is interviewing a woman with a very red mouth. And I don't know who she is, but boy, she had a red mouth. And after a couple of minutes, I realized, oh my gosh, that's Stephanie Meyer. And so later I went and Googled them both. I mean, I knew who Glenn Beck was, but I Googled them, and there was some strange and interesting stuff. But her new book is called The Host. Well, she has two new books. The Host is non-vampire, but it's about body snatchers, among other things. And then she's got a new one in the Twilight series, which is called Someone tell me. It's got Dawn in the title.
Breaking Dawn.
Breaking Dawn. Thank you. So this is a poem that came out of this weird conjunction of stuff, and it's called The Host. Then there were Stephanie and Glenn. She could free the adolescent inhibitions of the Heartland's kids, attracted to the twilight of sentimental superstition, where she imagined one young lion assumed the guise of lamb to sacrifice his taste for blood to budding romance. Thus began the dance. To peddle her new tale called The Host, story of the joint possession of a girl's tender body, he could boast an audience because he was coast to coast. Is it camp or sheer hysteria? Mormon celebrity's brave new world hurls the queen of vampire fiction into the arms of the affliction of the king of radical right-wing conviction, then into the embrace of their crazy mutual teenage fan base as they vamp each other. Electricity of composite eccentricity obtains a damp and dirty sycophantic syncopation, hard to stop, snap, crackle, pop. Together on the TV screen, she plays the modest Mormon mom. He poses, preens, and fawns upon her prose. "No smoking, drinking, sex," he says. "It's safe, and yet it's thrilling." She wills her scarlet lips to smile. Sexual tension, yes, but finds a flaw in those who calls her work erotic. Teens log on to blog their adulation. "Love you, Stephanie. Glenn is a god." Forget the body. Applaud the talk show host who snatches minds. It's kind of silly. It's not very serious. So, if you love Glenn or Stephanie, don't take it all too seriously. But the strange thing is, after her new book came out, The Host, before her latest new book, a friend of mine called me from a bookstore, I think it was Seagull Books, and she said, "I'm looking at the new Stephanie Meyer book, The Host. Guess what's just inside the front cover?" Turns out to be a poem called Question by Mae Swenson, my sister, who is one of the major poets of the last century, and I'm not, this is an unbiased. I mean, she's got, you know, she's in every major anthology of American poetry, and she died in 1989, but from the estate of Mae Swenson, Stephanie apparently obtained permission to publish Question, which is, I won't tell you what it is. It's a wonderful poem, but I having it in that context did a whole new spin. I don't know what to say. So, okay. So I attended a missionary reunion last summer. The first one I'd been to for many, many years. And I went because my brother convinced me to go, and my brother had been in the same mission. And a lot of interesting things happened there. I ran into a guy who was a legend in the Swedish mission, not for how many people he baptized, but all the wonderful, amusing stories and legendary stories that revolved around him. He used to answer the phone in the Göteborg Chapel. I'll pick you off one by one, but there's still a few. By saying, "Uncle Bob speaking, have you read the Book of Mormon?" Of course, he said that in Swedish, but he was there, and I hadn't seen him for many years, and he is a legend. Anyway, but I ran into somebody else there that I hadn't even thought about for a long time, and it led to this poem, which is called Companion. Hair was thick and black at 21. Handsome, debonair, his face had seen some sun. his missionary rep, Straight Arrow. In his eyes, a hint of humor. Before the Straight and Narrow, back in Brigham City, rumor had it, found a way to have some fun. Swedish summer's brevity sent migrants from the towns to bask in sunlight at the shore. Meant our tracking stats were down. Surely water, warmth, and welcome to share the Ternstrom's tent were grounds enough to ask we move our teaching to the beach, though mission rules were bent. Outdoors, my companion's natural habitat. Shielding the bright, I sat in the shade. But he insisted I parade the shore with him and proselyte. Illa Ternstrom, daring woman in her 40s, looked on our ministrations wistfully. Her husband read a book. Was she wrong to ask a curious question? If we went door to door, could she tag along? For one strange night, a new companion. Can't remember why, but just for fun, it was decided if the line were crossed to grant our best investigator's wish to missionary, I alone should be the one. Cottage doors we knocked on closed to us. I do recall the moon, scent in her hair, and Illa's brief incentive to try on the vestments of a faith she couldn't wear. Half century later, photos of that summer in a book. Two young men, one blonde, one dark, curving shoreline, recollection of a time and place. Look up to see an old man's pale and unfamiliar face, hair is thin and white, light in his eyes diminished and diffused. No, I want to say confused, but then he smiles. We had a wild time, he says. We were companions. Okay, I'm going to skip a couple here. So, a few months ago, before Barack Obama became the Democratic nominee, I was watching a debate, I think, with he and Hillary, and I noticed he was taking notes with his left hand. And I didn't know he was left-handed until then, but this led to a poem called Obama is a Lefty. Obama is a lefty, shifty, crafty, deft at using his right brain to carefully refrain from telling his right hand what his left is doing. Stuck his southpaw in the craw of race in Carolina. All those dusky faces resolute to place a black man in the White House. If that scares you, better pray he's not another MLK. Can't be sure a lefty isn't immigration friendly or even anti-war. What's more, say 08's election yields a dark horse from left field. What's next? A Muslim? An Hispanic? Or an open gay? Best be sure Obama followed by a comma or harsher punctuation won't expatriate the nation and change our common fate. It's only right that left of center meant you couldn't pay the rent to dream America. Now comes the shock that is Barack a lefty. Well, I'm maybe going to read one more. Let's see. Although this was written a long time ago, well, quite a while ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Wow, 3 years ago. It has even more relevance now, maybe. It's called Sweet to Sorrow. Parting such sweet to sorrow. Crave an impossible tomorrow, sharp, clean break from gasoline, oil withdrawal, residual ache for dregs of ancient creature in the earth. Must we beg the great machines concoct a fuel to cool their lust so we may quash our own addiction to the fiction that the amber liquid soothes a need for power or speed. Dream a smog-free dawn when the elixir's gone. We will breathe again. Will parched SUVs still long to guzzle at the pump, haunted by habitual consumption's want? Suppose that somewhere in a metal graveyard, rusting engine, the Hornet that I drove in college, wakes to feel a blip of latent thirst to sip the nectar of its errant youth. In truth, already I begin to miss the kindness of Sinclair, which offers us free air. Thank you. If you have questions or comments, come to the mic, and I'll pass this mic to folks. Come to the mic. No, it's in this. I have it in Sunstone. I have it in the magazine. Is that what the one you mean?
The one that's published in this magazine.
The new magazine has two of my poems, which are very kind. Are you suggesting that poem?
Yeah.
Don't you have more urgent things on your minds?
Than blogging? Come on.
It is a poem that came from looking at Gorman blogs, a new and rather wonderful thing. You know the blog, Feminist Mormon Housewives, that's a great blog. And as is Times and Seasons, and By Common Consent, there's actually dozens of them.
But how about Gordon Journal?
Yes, well, one of the people who always comes to Sunstone, her name on the internet is Bored in Vernal. Although she lives now in South Carolina, and most recently was in Saudi Arabia, so she shouldn't be bored at this point. Oh, this is called the Modesty Blog. Modesty is the hottest topic in the bloggernacle. The bloggernacle, I'm sort of interrupting my own poem, but the bloggernacle is the Mormon word for what in the wider world is called the blogosphere, which means the whole shebang. Modesty is the hottest topic in the bloggernacle. The body is a tabernacle and must be covered by a sack or tent in order to prevent the baring of a shoulder or of skin above an older woman's ankle. If you are female, what you're wearing may be sin. If it inflames the lust of Mormon males, whose lonely struggle with testosterone entails that they avert their eyes or disguise awareness of a woman's bust or thighs. Not only men are penitent about forbidden thoughts that may arise from tight, revealing clothing. Heterosexual married woman writes that she is flustered by modesty, won't notice breasts of women clad in modest tees, she says, but please avoid a clingy shift, especially if it's cold. Catch my drift? Some bloggers hasten to confess a secret yearning for a sundress, or self-consciously disclose they burn to wear J. Crew as liberated women do. A few still grieve they bought the obligation to venerate the sleeve as sanctified when they put on the Mormon vestments of a bride. When slogging through the product of male blogs, observe a certain reticence to gauge appropriateness of manly dress. Accept the rightness of white shirts and ties, which leaves guys free to contemplate indecent penchants of their mates. Tim scathingly complains he can't imagine why their mothers can't refrain from dressing little girls in two-piece bathing suits. Another dense galoot alludes to a distressing prevalence of non-wife nudity. That's the phrase he uses. Non-wife nudity. Forgive my rudeness if I see beauty in the human form and do not look away. Show me the marbled limbs of lovers and Rodin's The Kiss, and Pray, the full-blown masculinity of David by Michelangelo, artist who sculpted us to model God and goddess, may find idolatrous and pat fixation on false modesty. What of that? So, if you have questions or comments, please come to the microphone, and I'll pass the mic to the folks. People are shuffling their feet as if they're almost. Oh, come on! You've got something in your minds. And here he comes. There you go.
Would the three of you please keep writing?
That's too easy. Thank you. At least one more. Come on. We've got 30 seconds. No, we're not. I thought we did. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.